Support for KQED comes from European Sleepworks, the store that bases its design and materials on research factors affecting sleep, including comfort and support, humidity levels, and ease of breathing. Details online about their mattresses and bedding at sleepworks.com. News from the BBC is just ahead. On KQED Television, civil rights leaders Art Johnson and Pepe Peña are a force behind LGBTQ+ equality through their iconic gay bar in Chicago. Catch the story of the long struggle for equality and their fight to love freely in a new Pride Month special of Art and Pep Monday night at 9 on KQED 9. Partly cloudy tonight with haze and lows in the 50s. Clouds will linger tomorrow, but Sunday afternoon will be sunny. I'm Michelle Hennigan. Steve Fox is here for the late shift, and this is KQED San Francisco and KQEI North Highland, Sacramento at 11 p.m.
Hello from the BBC. You are listening to Weekend. I'm Luke Jones. The Danish Prime Minister has been assaulted in Copenhagen, a despicable act, one EU leader says. We'll hear from a German MP who was herself attacked recently.
I was there in the middle of the streets talking to people about the European elections. Then this man approached me aggressively and then hit me.
As more voters head to the polls in EU elections, we'll speak to the Polish foreign minister. What is at stake for Europe? Also on Weekend, the Taylor Swift tour circus lands in the UK. Why are fans though going to this particular pub?
I just thought it was cool to be able to come here and say, oh my gosh, I went to the place that Taylor Swift wrote her song about.
And so I watched as you walk into some bar called the Black Dog.
Plenty more of that here on Weekend.
Hello, I'm David Harper with the BBC News. William Anders, the American astronaut who took the first colour photograph of the Earth from the Moon, has died in a plane crash. He was 90 years old. Anders was one of the three crew members on board Apollo 8, the first manned mission to the Moon in 1968. The photo showing the blue Earth rising above the lunar horizon became a cultural sensation credited with kick-starting the environmental movement. Here's Peter Bowes.
Retired Major General William Anders was piloting a small vintage plane when it crashed off the San Juan Islands in Washington State. Footage shows the aircraft nosediving into the ocean. Confirming his father's death, Greg Anders said their family was devastated. The iconic Earthrise photograph is one of the most memorable and inspirational images of Earth from space. Taken on Christmas Eve during the 1968 Apollo 8 mission, it shows the planet rising above the horizon from the barren surface of the Moon.
A row is intensifying between Israel and the United Nations after the UN added the country's military to a list of entities committing violations against children alongside Hamas. The Israeli Prime Minister Benjamin Netanyahu said the UN was delusional, but the Secretary-General's spokesman said the methodology behind the report was well established and transparent. Violations are reported to include attacks on schools and hospitals and the denial of aid. A senior White House official has said Russia, China and North Korea are expanding and diversifying their nuclear arsenals at breakneck speed. Pranay Vadi suggested the United States might in future have to increase its deployments to counteract them. Here's Will Leonardo.
This is a stark warning from Pranay Vadi, the National Security Council arms control expert, which may herald a nuclear arms race not seen since the Cold War. In a speech to an organisation advocating arms control, Mr. Vadi suggested US stockpiles may need to increase to preserve its deterrence. He said China, Russia and North Korea were showing no interest in limiting their nuclear programmes and were coordinating with each other. Mr. Vadi's comments come after repeated thinly veiled nuclear threats from President Putin. Washington currently keeps to a 2010 treaty with Russia, limiting deployed warheads to 1,550. Moscow has suspended its participation in that agreement.
Britain's second televised election debate has yielded more sustained criticism of Prime Minister Rishi Sunak for leaving the D-Day commemorations early on Thursday. The representative from his Conservative Party, Penny Mordaunt, said the move was wrong, but stressed that Mr. Sunak had apologised. The Scottish National Party Westminster leader, Stephen Flynn, responded with a scathing attack.
A Prime Minister who puts his own political career before public service is no Prime Minister at all. A Prime Minister who puts his own political career before Normandy war veterans is no Prime Minister at all.
BBC News. The US Supreme Court Justice Clarence Thomas has acknowledged for the first time in his annual financial reports that he'd taken two luxury trips in 2019, paid for by a Republican donor. The gifts were first reported by an investigative news site last year, leading to calls for him to resign. The financial reports have also revealed that the Liberal Justice Ketanji Brown Jackson received concert tickets worth nearly $4,000 from Beyoncé. The disclosures come as America's top court is under increasing scrutiny over its transparency and accountability measures. Four countries are voting today for members of the European Parliament on the third of four voting days across the European Union. In Slovakia, opinion polls suggest last month's assassination attempt on the Prime Minister Robert Fico has propelled his populist party into the lead. In Italy, the Prime Minister Giorgia Meloni's party is predicted to perform well amid a wave of growing far-right support across Europe. The United States Coast Guard has seized more than 2,000 kilos of cocaine worth over $63 million in two separate interceptions of drug smuggling boats in the Caribbean Sea north of Venezuela. Ian McWilliam has more detail.
The cocaine, neatly packed in dozens of black bags, has been offloaded from a U.S. Coast Guard ship at Port Everglades in Florida. It has a street value of more than $63 million. It was seized in two separate incidents in the Caribbean, off the coast of Venezuela, near the Dutch Antilles. In one incident, the smuggler's boat was fired at when it veered towards a Dutch Caribbean Coast Guard vessel, also involved in the altercation. The boat burst into flames and sank, and three suspected smugglers jumped overboard. They haven't been found. The cocaine was recovered from the sunken boat.
Verona in Italy has hosted some of the world's biggest classical music stars for an event celebrating the addition of Italian opera onto UNESCO's list of intangible global heritage. Hundreds of musicians performed masterpieces from composers including Verdi and Puccini. BBC News.
Hello, welcome to Weekend on the BBC. I'm Luke Jones, here to stave off my loneliness in the studio. I have Alec Russell, foreign editor for the Financial Times newspaper, and Suzanne Lynch, associate editor of Politico, the US news website, is joining us from Brussels. Morning again to the both of you. Let's delve into a bit of the work you've been doing currently. Suzanne, if I start with you, you've recently been looking at, the Ukrainian president's effort to try and win the hearts and minds of the so-called global south. Why that?
Yes, I mean, this has been a consistent theme since that full-scale invasion of Ukraine back in February 2022. How does Ukraine make its case to the rest of the world? I mean, the support of Europe and America, basically the NATO countries, is pretty much there. I mean, we've obviously seen delays in funding in the US and we've seen some jitters in Europe, but it's pretty much there. It's a different story across the rest of the world. So I was at the, it's called the Shangri-La Dialogue. It's a big defense summit that takes place every year in Singapore. So I attended that last weekend. I was covering that. And as I was busy listening to there was the representative senior government and prime ministers from all over the region, from the Philippines, Malaysia, Indonesia. And then we had heard rumours, but then finally it emerged that President Zelensky himself was going to arrive at this summit. It was quite dramatic, but in a sense, it was quite, for me as a journalist who's been covering Zelensky and the war here from the European perspective, to see him in this completely different environment trying to make his case was fascinating. I was in the room, he was giving his speech, but really it was difficult for him. It's difficult for Ukraine to break through. He didn't really come away from that trip with any commitments as such. His main role in going there was to try and encourage these countries to attend a peace summit that he is holding next weekend in Switzerland. And he gave, he made the parallels. He said, you know, if Putin isn't stopped, that, in a sense, sets down a model for other dictators. Without naming any countries in particular, you had the Philippines in the room and you had Chinese officials in the room. But one of his challenges now, and this is what I was writing about, was that the war in Gaza, I think, has changed the calculation for a lot of countries in the so-called global south, because there would be traditionally a more pro-Palestinian view in these countries.
Yeah.
And they are kind of saying, hang on, you're the West lecturing us about rule of law and how we have to stand on Ukraine's side. What about the Palestinians in Gaza and what's happening there? So there has been an added layer of complications now
Alec,
for Zelensky to deal with.
Yeah, Alec, it's an interesting dynamic, isn't it, especially on the Ukrainian war. I mean, we're used to seeing photos, as we did from Normandy the other day, of Zelensky being warmly welcomed by Western leaders, and yet we forget quite often that there's this whole other dynamic going on.
Oh, no, absolutely. I think, I mean, I remember being infuriated soon after the full-scale invasion, not just infuriated by the invasion, to be clear, which I think is a catastrophe, but by the way, quite a lot of people would refer to the world being united in outrage, and you know what? The world wasn't united in outrage then, and it's much of the world is even less outraged now, as Suzanne rightly was just pointing out. I spend quite a lot of time travelling in the part of the world known sweepingly as the global south, parts of Asia, Latin America, Africa, and the sentiment has been pretty unchanged, which is just, you know what, this isn't our war, it's the West's war. You and the West are trying to make out that it's a big global issue. We don't see it as a big global issue.
Yeah, we were talking an hour ago about your beginnings in Dubrovnik, and speaking of your travels, you're going back to the Balkans.
Do you know, I'm going back to the Balkans this week for the first to report for the first time in oh goodness, nearly 30 years. The reason being, well, one, the Western Balkans is a very interesting, important part of the world, but it's also, I feel very strongly that at a time when there are these two wrenching conflicts taking place that are dominating the news, it's namely Ukraine and Gaza, it's very easy for us to lose sight of what else is happening, easy for policymakers to lose sight of it, easier for the media to lose sight of it. I know you're turning to Sudan later on in the program, which is terrific, but I'm going to go to Serbia for a few days and talk to the president and try and work out how much of a problem for Europe the Western Balkans is.
More from you, Alec and Suzanne, in a moment. Let's turn to one of our top stories today, which is what's been happening in Copenhagen. The European Council's president, Charles Michel, has expressed his shock at the assault on the Danish Prime Minister, Mette Frederiksen, which took place yesterday. The Prime Minister's office said a man had hit her, while two witnesses said he shoved her hard on the shoulder. Let's go live to Lena Teels, who's a Danish journalist, actually sometimes a panellist on this programme. She joins us live from Copenhagen. Morning, Lena.
Good morning.
What do we know exactly about what happened?
Well, apparently Mette Frederiksen was coming up from a train station. Nørreport was sort of in the centre of Copenhagen. She was meeting up with a friend in a cafe, and this is something that she does quite frequently. She just walks around in the city, but she is accompanied with bodyguards from the police, about three or four at any given time. And they weren't that close, and apparently she passes a man and he shoves her very, very hard. So that's what we know so far. The Prime Minister hasn't commented further, and the police have just sort of acknowledged this is happening. They are investigating the case, but they haven't given us any details so far.
And we know that a man has been arrested. It's interesting. Some people listening in different parts of the world might be shocked at the idea of her just wandering around, even with bodyguards. That seems quite unusual for a world leader.
Well, it's Denmark, and you know, we've always been used to being able to do that. We've always seen ourselves as a more sort of democratic, not a dangerous country, but I'm sure that this will have some effect. It's not the first time a Danish Prime Minister has been attacked, I must say. We had our former Prime Minister, Anders Fogh Rasmussen, who later on became leader of NATO, he was once attacked with red paint. So it has happened before, and that led to sort of a lot of tightening of security around the parliament. And I'm sure this will also have some kind of effect on how Mette Frederiksen will move around now in the landscape. There will be probably a tightening of security.
Of course, this all comes in the middle of the campaign for the elections for the EU Parliament, and we've seen instances of violence in other countries, which we'll discuss a little bit later on, most notably, of course, Slovakia and in Germany as well. I wonder what you're sensing from the commentary in Denmark, Lena, about how this campaign might be particularly angry compared to previous ones, if that is the case.
Well, she was actually just, she had just been participating in an election program on television when she was attacked. And whether there's a connection there, we don't know. But I did have a sort of look last night on social media, and I must say I came from there a little bit disheartened and a little bit shocked, because there's so much anger out there. Mm. I don't think it's necessarily connected as such to the European Parliament election, but it's connected to Gaza. Yeah. It's connected to sort of a general frustration over the politicians. Some people were still mentioning the COVID vaccines and the shutdown. So there is a lot of anger out there. Yeah. And there were people saying, oh, she deserved it, I'm happy he did it. And equally, of course, there were people saying violence is never, ever the solution. This is not an attack on her, it's an attack on the very core of our democracy.
Do you think that the events of yesterday will have an impact on how people vote this weekend?
Probably not. I think, you know, but having said that, people are very much in doubt in Denmark. The situation politically is that people are not sticking with the parties that they normally vote for. They're sort of looking for something else. So parties that usually are quite sure of getting mandates, they might get zero. People, parties who don't normally get a lot of mandates get more. So it's going to be an interesting election for sure. Mm. Whether this will sort of gain sympathy for the Social Democrats, which is the party of Mette Frederiksen, is yet to be seen.
Yes. Luna, thank you very much for joining us this morning. That's Luna Teels, a Danish journalist. As I said, sometimes you'll hear her on Weekend as a panellist with the latest on what's been happening with the Danish Prime Minister. Suzanne, we'll talk a bit more about violence generally in this campaign that we've seen, but just on this particular incident, I mean, were you especially shocked or not?
Well, I can tell you I was last night when this news started filtering through. As I say, you know, we're on election footing here in Brussels. All the European Parliament is ready for these results on Sunday. There's a lot of activity here. And to hear this news last night, I think everyone was shocked. Thankfully, you know, it doesn't seem as serious as it may have been. So in that sense, it probably mirrors the reaction to when we had heard about the attack on Robert Fico, the Slovakian president, which is obviously a lot more serious. He was shocked, but at one point there, people thought it could have been even worse. So it's almost, it's adding to that sense of anxiety, of low-level disruption and anxiety and uncertainty that people are feeling here, and that I think reflects this bubbling antagonism and anger that is out there in the electorate.
Alec, do you think something especially different is going on at the moment, or is politics always unfortunately been a bit like this?
Well, obviously, politicians have been subject to attacks for centuries. But I think what is depressing about this is that it's just a reminder how increasingly politicians in many countries, not just Denmark, are having to keep themselves further away from the public than they used to. And I don't know if that's a reflection of a sort of an angrier political climate, whether it's, dare I say it, back to the role of social media, sort of riling different factions or whatever. But the fact of the matter is that if you're a politician today in a number of Western liberal democracies, for example, where traditionally you might have thought it's fine to just trot along the street and chat to people, you are now going to be looking over your shoulder much more. That's rather depressing.
Alec Russell, Suzanne Lynch, more from you both in a moment. You're listening to Weekend on the BBC World Service. This week, veterans, members of the public and world leaders descended on Normandy in northern France for the 80th anniversary commemorations of the D-Day landings, a key turning point in the Second World War, the largest amphibious invasion the world has ever seen. There were plenty of speeches by the US president and the French president, who both, addressing Ukraine's President Zelensky, who was also there, made mention of Russia's invasion. But in the UK, all of this has somewhat been overshadowed by a political misstep by Prime Minister Rishi Sunak. We're in the middle of an election campaign in the UK, and Rishi Sunak attended the events in Normandy, but missed the final part with the assembled international leaders. After a brief outcry at this, he was finally forced to apologise.
The itinerary for these events was set weeks ago, before the start of the general election campaign, and having participated in all the British events with British veterans, I returned home before the International Leaders event later in the day. On reflection, that was a mistake and I apologise.
The leader of the Labour Party, Keir Starmer, who was at that event, said his priority had been the veterans. Some of the people in his party said that Mr Sunak had committed a dereliction of duty. In the latest televised election debates, which was last night, even one of Rishi Sunak's own cabinet allies said what he did was wrong, but he was right to apologise. Has this then been an offensive and politically expensive misstep in a country which takes its war history and commemoration so seriously? I've been speaking to former Major General Tim Cross.
I think, like everybody, I was disappointed. I do accept the apology. I think it's not unimportant that politicians, and indeed any of us, acknowledge when we've made a mistake and apologise for it. Mm. I happen to be a Christian, so I do believe in forgiveness and, you know, moving on. We don't need to bury the poor guy. But nonetheless, I was disappointed, and I do think it was a mistake to walk away from it, from these commemorations, for various reasons, really, but not least of which, I was heavily involved in the D-Day commemorations over the years while I was serving. I had the great privilege of organising and running the final parade on the beach at Arromanches for the 50th anniversary, when we had something like 12,000 veterans and a lot of politicians, of course. And we had a weeks-long commemoration, and everybody stayed over there for that whole week. It wasn't the middle of a general election campaign, obviously, but nonetheless, you know, that's what people did. Now, of course, we've probably got less than 100 who are alive, and this is really the last time that we as a nation can show them our appreciation. And I do think these things are important. Commemorations are important. Remembrance is important, both for the individuals concerned, not just the veterans who are on the beaches themselves and doing other things on D-Day, but their families and the consequences of the families whose brothers, husbands, sons died on the beaches and indeed elsewhere in that Normandy campaign. But as a nation, it's really important that we collectively think about what happened on D-Day and indeed on other campaigns, and particularly for our senior leadership, reflect on how we can avoid having to send thousands of people to their deaths in future wars.
When you were part of those 50th anniversary commemorations that you mentioned, did anyone leave early then?
No. I mean, everybody was there for the week, as I say. Now, I say that, that's unfair. Some people have not been there the whole week, but there was serious representation for the whole week.
Yes.
And the key day, the 6th of June, both the 5th, 6th of June, were fully represented by everybody.
Why do you think that it is particularly taken so seriously in the UK as opposed to in other countries?
I don't know, really. I think it's part of our national character. I mean, we have these conversations about, you know, what does it mean to be British and so forth. Mm. We do have a sense of history. And I've been watching a series of programs by Professor Richard Holmes, who was a great friend of mine, who did war walks and looked at various campaigns over the centuries. And we, of course, you know, we did suffer terribly during World War One and World War Two. We had commitments around the world that we were still involved with post-World War Two, and indeed are still committed to. I think generally speaking, it's part of who we are, recognizing that we have a responsibility to engage in world affairs and have done so in the past, will do so in the future. But in doing that, there is, you know, there's a downside. There are casualties as a result of it. And we need to remember that and commemorate it at the appropriate times.
Is there a mistrust, do you think, between politicians and military types? We're having this constant debate about whether the armed force in the UK is funded properly enough. We've had instances in recent history where politicians and military leadership haven't necessarily seen eye to eye. Do you think there's just something about our political classes that just don't actually quite understand?
Well, there is something about a mismatch. I mean, it's only relatively recently we've ended up with the majority of MPs never having served in the military. Mm. I mean, people like all of the leaders post-World War II had obviously fought in World War II and had been involved in World War II. And so most of that generation who served in politics had served in the military. I mean, I joined as a cadet in 1964, which was barely 20 years after D-Day, and everybody in the nation had been involved one way or the other with World War II. The current influx of MPs into Parliament, it's very rare that any of them have got anything to do with the military at all. They certainly don't have the same understanding and engagement with the defence. There are exceptions, but there is a bit of a divide there. But I don't think we have enough conversation and discussion about foreign policy and about how we're going to engage with the world. There's a deeper conversation that needs to be had, and I don't think enough of our politicians have a real sense of what that looks like and therefore prefer to focus in on domestic issues.
That is former Major General Tim Cross speaking to me a little bit earlier on. Alec Russell and Suzanne Lynch are still with me. Suzanne, it's always interesting to gauge how far these domestic political scandals travel. I mean, have you picked up much of it in the press where you are?
Well, I think it did take people by surprise. Not huge coverage here, but it's an extraordinary story that it seemed like an own goal. I mean, it's not as if the other politicians that were present don't have a lot on their plate. Biden, President Biden, is fighting an election in the United States, and his son is currently in court. You know, you've got Olaf Scholz, the German Chancellor, who is grappling with a very kind of weak coalition government, and Macron himself. They're all just ahead of elections here over the weekend. So the idea that you would leave because there is an election, I think, just doesn't hold water when it compares to the other leaders there. And then it also gives an open space to Keir Starmer, who the opposition leader, who is a relatively unknown quantity here in Europe. So I think people are interested in him. The fact that he was present, I think, was significant, and in many ways would have been the first time that audiences in Europe have seen him or have been exposed to him because he was attending the event.
There was an interesting moment where all the leaders were sort of gathering at the start of the event, and Keir Starmer had quite a good chunk of time with President Zelensky. He sort of held him in conversation for quite a time, which I imagine that interesting to hear what maybe they were saying to one another. Alec, what do you make of this?
Well, I thought just when you thought it couldn't get any worse for Rishi Sunak and the Conservative Party, this will go down as one of the epic mishaps of an election campaign. More seriously, I do think that one of the points that the general was making is very valid. This sort of issue of age. I was talking to one or two people yesterday who were suggesting that part of the problem was that many of the people advising Rishi Sunak were quite young, and their social media streams and feeds just were not reflecting the D-Day commemorations. Whereas I know from speaking to my 85-year-old mother that the older generation, including many conservative voters who are found amongst people in their 70s and 80s, should we say, they were glued to their television sets watching this for 24 hours. Mm. So massive mishap. And I think it also reflects that, as some of Rishi Sunak's critics say from within the Conservative Party, maybe he's just not particularly good at politics.
And also, Suzanne, it was interesting what Major General Tim Cross was saying earlier about how there are fewer military figures actually on the elected benches in the House of Parliament, and that maybe that accounts for why maybe our political classes and military types seem sort of quite far apart at the moment.
Yeah, I mean, there is a generation issue, but it's not just, I mean, it's the one issue, not the one, but it's an issue that unites as Britain to Europe so much, that shared history, that shared awful history of World War II. And particularly at the moment when Britain has taken a leading role in Europe when it comes to the response to the war in Ukraine, it's a leading member of NATO, and the war in Ukraine has been a way for Britain to show the world, look, just because we're outside the EU, it does not mean we're outside of Europe. That phrase we heard during the Brexit referendum. So because this was such an easy kind of photo op, if you like, to be cynical about this, the very fact that Rishi Sunak couldn't see that and couldn't see, as a leader, what his role is, it's more than just fighting, you know, a general election. It's leading your country. Mm. And that picture, I think what will really go down in history is the picture where it's some of the leaders, and then David Cameron is there standing in instead of Rishi Sunak, the Foreign Secretary. And for one moment when I saw this on social media, I thought it had been photoshopped in. You know, people were saying, he's a former Prime Minister, why is he in the photo? And then you realise it was true.
Yeah.
I think what Alex was saying there about, I mean, we know this as journalists, you come up very close to politicians and you see their team of advisors around them. And I'd love to be a fly on the wall for the debrief to say, you know, why did no one shout stop? And you never know. But I mean, I think this will go down as history as one of those moments.
Well, we'll see. We've still got 3 weeks, I think it is, of this election campaign. I always find it funny when you hear Americans tiring of their campaign so far. They've got all the way till November, but only 3 weeks left of this here in the UK. Suzanne, Alec, thank you both so much for the moments. You're listening to Weekend on the BBC. I have Alec Russell, foreign editor for the FT, with me, and Suzanne Lynch, associate editor of Politico. There's plenty more ahead. Do stay with us. You're listening to the BBC World Service.
The BBC World Service is made possible by American Public Media as the largest station-based public radio organization in the U.S. APM offers award-winning content to audiences everywhere. The BBC World Service connects audiences to the world. From international news to arts and culture programming, listeners hear global stories and perspectives not heard anywhere else.
Support for KQED comes from European Sleepworks, the store that bases its design and materials on research factors affecting sleep, including comfort and support, humidity levels, and ease of breathing. Details online about their mattresses and bedding at sleepworks.com. Keep pace with the world. Stream KQED live through our app and get your news on demand anywhere you go.
Hello and welcome to Weekend from the BBC. I'm Luke Jones. We will discuss political violence in the run-up to the European Parliament elections in a moment. The latest, of course, is the Danish Prime Minister being assaulted in Copenhagen. We'll speak to a German MP who had something similar happen to her in this campaign. Also, with the gargantuan Taylor Swift tour landing in the UK, we will go to the pub which fans have oddly been congregating in. That's ahead on Weekend.
BBC News with David Harper. William Anders, the American astronaut who took the famous Earthrise photo during the Apollo 8 lunar mission in 1968, has died after a plane he was piloting crashed in Washington State. He was 90 years old. A row is intensifying between Israel and the United Nations after the UN added the country's military to a list of entities allegedly committing violations against children alongside Hamas. Israel's UN envoy leaked the news a week before the list was due to be presented to the Security Council. Brazilian police say they will send extradition requests to Argentina next week for a number of fugitives who fled there after being accused of involvement in attacks against government buildings in Brasilia last year. It's unclear if the Argentine government will accept the request. The United States Coast Guard has seized more than 2,000 kilos of cocaine worth over $63 million. It came in two separate interceptions of drug smuggling boats in the Caribbean Sea. A senior White House official has said Russia, China and North Korea are expanding and diversifying their nuclear arsenals at breakneck speed. Pranay Vadi said the three showed no interest in arms control. Four countries are voting today for members of the European Union Parliament. In Slovakia, opinion polls put the populist party of Prime Minister Robert Fico in the lead. In Italy, Prime Minister Giorgia Meloni's party is predicted to perform well. Malta and Latvia also vote today. Verona in Italy has hosted some of the world's biggest classical music stars for an event celebrating the addition of Italian opera to UNESCO's list of intangible global heritage. Hundreds of musicians perform masterpieces from composers including Verdi and Puccini. A 10-storey apartment block nearing completion close to the Japanese capital Tokyo is to be demolished following complaints it was blocking a popular view of Mount Fuji. Photos of the structure show it perfectly blocking half of the celebrated volcano's conical peak. BBC News.
Hello, welcome along to Weekend. I'm Luke Jones. You're listening to the BBC World Service. I have keeping me company today Alec Russell, foreign editor for the Financial Times, and Suzanne Lynch, who is associate editor of Politico, the US news website. Alec with me in the studio here in London, and Suzanne down the line in Brussels. The back half of this week has seen and will see 370 million people voting in 27 countries. EU members are electing members of the EU Parliament. It is the world's second biggest democratic election after India's. There are 720 seats in the EU Parliament. Each country has a number of seats proportionate to their population. And voting doesn't happen all at once. It takes place over several days. On Wednesday, the Netherlands was voting, for example. Tomorrow, votes will be cast in countries like Poland and Germany. Today, Italy and Slovakia are amongst those voting. Many are keeping an eye on these elections because it could see a big shift rightwards in some parts. Far-right parties are expecting to do especially well in France, Belgium, Austria and Italy. And concerningly, it has been a somewhat violent campaign. As we've been discussing, the Danish Prime Minister has been assaulted in the streets in Copenhagen. There have also been attacks on politicians in Germany. And this not long after the Slovakian Prime Minister was almost killed in a shooting. Well, let's discuss. Live with us from Poland is the Polish Foreign Minister, Radek Sikorski. Good morning.
Hello, good morning.
Also down the line from Germany is Jana Pulieri, and good morning to you.
Morning.
Mr. Corsi, if I could start with you first of all, your reaction to the news that we had out of Copenhagen. Is this an unusually violent campaign so far, do you fear?
Well, it's appalling, and of course my heart goes out to the Prime Minister. You know, you've had a political murder, Joe Cox, the appalling assault on Prime Minister Fico. Us politicians are also vulnerable.
Jana? I think we might have lost Jana. Apologies. We'll try and get back to her at some point. Mr. Sikorski, if I could carry on with you. I mentioned there that the far right are expecting to do well. They have done well in elections before, of course, in France and Italy. I guess the new thing here is that they might be able to form a bloc in the parliament. Is that something that you fear?
Well, there are two far right blocs. There is the far right and then there is the extreme right. They are Europhobic. They are getting help, some of them, from Putin, who would like to destroy the European Union from within. They're also being helped by people assaulting the external border of the EU, who want to show that we don't have control, which we do, and in that way help the far right.
Jana, Mr. Sikorski was just saying there that he thinks part of the reason why the far right is maybe doing well is that there's some Russian influence potentially at play there. Do you think that's what accounts for it, or is it actually really just what a lot of people are thinking?
So I think there is definitely Russian influence, Russian disinformation. There's Russian support for far-right parties in Europe, but I would not overload this because I think that many of our problems are homemade, that far-right parties identify existing problems that many so-called mainstream parties have not addressed. For example, in Germany, the issue of migration for a long time was not really dealt with the way that the broader public thought that people had control. And so I think it's actually both, but I also think we should not always point to Russia, but also look at ourselves and what have we done wrong to appeal so many people, actually.
Radek Sikorski, if the far right is going to do well, it's a mainstream party failure as opposed to their success.
I think that's correct. The history of parliamentary democracy shows that extreme movements usually latch on or to an issue that the establishment ignored for too long. And the way to solve it is to take the rational core of what people are concerned about and to solve the problem. Because extremists pretend that there are simple solutions to difficult problems. Migration, how to balance the need to control borders with humanitarian treatment of migrants is a difficult issue.
And do you accept your role in that? If that's the case, if mainstream parties have been ignoring issues that members of the public have been interested in and worried about, I mean, is that a failure of yourself as well?
Well, we've adopted the Migration Pact, which means that there will now be these reception centres where potential migrants will be told quickly whether they have a chance to gain international protection or not, and if not, they'll be sent back to their countries. I think that's a move in the right direction.
Of course, these elections are also happening at a point where Europe, in the larger sense, is at war. Jana, do you think that will affect the dynamic of what could happen?
To a certain extent. For example, in Germany, we have a new party. It's called Bündnis Sarah Wagenknecht. It's basically left-leaning, but also national conservative at the same time. And one of their kind of arguments is that basically the mainstream parties in Germany have been too critical with Russia and that we need to change course. They are aligned with that, with the German far-right party, the Alternative für Deutschland. And here, foreign policy plays an unusually popular role in the election campaign. Usually, foreign policy doesn't play such a big role, but in Germany, you see posters. You know, that's the way we campaign in Germany, with kind of these huge posters. Mm. And you see that the far right and the Bündnis Sarah Wagenknecht, as well as the far left, use this peace narrative to their advantage.
Well, it's Sikorski, what about you? Do you think that actually the war being so close to Europe actually will affect how people vote?
I think so. In Poland, we have a palpable sense of threat because 250 kilometers from our capital, on a plain piece of landscape, we have a physical border with Belarus, over which Putin and Lukashenko are trying to push people that they've invited from Africa and Asia. And yes, there is the Alternative for Deutschland, for example, is arguing for the restoration of the import of gas from Russia, which Putin desperately needs. So we shouldn't exaggerate, but naivete is also not a virtue. The Russians were active in the Brexit referendum, and they are active today.
And
they are financing these parties. I mean, we just had a huge scandal in Germany looking at two members of the AfD, of the Alternative für Deutschland, one actually the lead candidate of the European election now, and they were involved in financial scandals with regards to Russia and China, spying scandals. So there is definitely foreign influence. What I just want to say is I think many people in Europe are currently just overwhelmed by the magnitude of the crises. It's not just the war, it's also economic problems, it's climate. And there, I think far-right parties very often present very easy solutions and they kind of reduce the complexity of these complex problems. I think they are wrong, their approach is wrong, but I think that is also what makes them so successful.
And of course, if this is having an effect on how people vote, the most immediate sort of result of that will be in the makeup, finally, of the EU Parliament, what that will look like. Mr. Sikorski, do you think that actually how the Parliament looks could actually affect how the war in Ukraine goes in any way? Or is the EU Parliament just too toothless for that?
Well, it's not toothless. I expect the coalition capacity of the main parties in the European Parliament to be about the same after this election. But, you know, the fact that you are asking us about the European Parliament means that it actually has power. It can elect the next commission. It approves the budgets. It approves European directives. It even benefits you in Britain, even though you're no longer in the European Union. You know, we have the system of Rome is at home. That benefits you. We forced Apple to introduce USB-C on the phones, that there'll be less electrical rubbish. And we've just forced industry to make their white goods capable of being repaired. Mm. Once that standard is imposed, you will benefit from it too.
Jana, how do you see the next 5 years faring?
So I think the centre will hold. I completely agree with Radek here. But I think the legislative process in some areas will become more complicated if the far right is as successful as forecasts currently see it. I think especially when it comes to the climate issue, when it comes to rule of law, where the parliament has had a very strong voice. Also the whole issue of migration. So I think while the centre still holds, and especially I think on Ukraine will be able to push through many decisions, there will be more pushback. There will be maybe a bigger need to involve the far right in decision making. The European Parliament is not, like the coalition that elects von der Leyen is not that stable. So there is an issue by issue vote very often. And also when it comes to the budget, think the ammunition initiative, the EU one, there needs to be money approved that needs to go through Parliament, and we will have more sympathies for Russia in the European Parliament if the far right surges.
Jana Pulgarian from the European Council on Foreign Relations, and also Radek Sikorski, Foreign Minister of Poland. Thank you both for joining us here on Weekend. I'm back with my panel, Alec Russell and Suzanne Lynch. Suzanne, what did you make of that? I mean, the problem with these EU elections usually is a lack of enthusiasm, isn't it? It's low turnout.
Well, that is one element. And what you've seen, for example, in Poland, Mr. Sikorski's country, is a real effort by his party to try and get out the vote. Look, European elections are unique. They only happen every 5 years. And there's been a tradition, ironically, that anti-EU candidates tend to do well in the European elections. So we've had over the years people like Nigel Farage from Britain and Marine Le Pen in France being elected to the European Parliament and actually forming a kind of an anti-EU bloc within the Parliament. And it's because that, I mean, surveys show this time and time again, that citizens across Europe will often vote for candidates in the European elections that they would not vote for domestically. Mm. And then secondly, it's often seen as a protest vote towards your own domestic government. In saying that, I mean, the immediate issue that is that if the far right surges, that will affect, as you've explained there, the makeup of the parliament, and you will have more right-wing figures in the parliament, and that will, shape policy more to the right. But there's another part of this, and that's that once these elections finish, and on Sunday night we start seeing results, then another process happens, which is the appointment of the EU's top jobs, including the President of the European Commission, Ursula von der Leyen, who wants to lead for another 5 years. But at the moment, it looks like she doesn't have the votes, or it's going to be hard for her. The Parliament has to approve her, and she only got through by 9 votes the last time. So I think what's going to be interesting is, if the far right does well, and she is kind of scrambling for votes, she may have to do deals with those parties. And that means that not only do you have a shift in the European Parliament, you also have a shift in the European Commission and in other parts of the EU system around the European Council table, where they have to listen more to the far right. So I think that's what's going to be very interesting. And figures like Giorgia Meloni in Italy, now she's going to be very important here. She is Italy, one of the biggest countries in the EU, has got a lot of MEPs, but she has been quietly exhibiting power and showing her presence when she comes to Brussels for EU meetings. She's one of the most right-wing leaders in Italy's modern history, and may not feel like that, but a lot of her policies are on the right. And von der Leyen has already got into hot water by saying that she works well with Meloni. So I think the idea that Giorgia Meloni may be some kind of a kingmaker in the next EU system for the next 5 years is a fascinating prospect. Mm.
And interesting, actually, how all those results just from the Parliament can filter up and maybe cause a bit of drama at the top, Suzanne, as you suggest. Alec?
Well, quite right, I think, for us to focus on the position of Italy's Prime Minister, Giorgia Meloni, after this. She's rapidly emerging as an extraordinarily influential figure in what happens next in Europe. I'm interested in two things from these elections. Not, I confess, the makeup of all the different groupings, important as it is, but I see the result as being something of a sort of litmus test for the strength of the right more broadly. And of course, we are now looking ahead just a couple of years to a massive election in France, with Marine Le Pen pushing hard from the far right. The other thing I'm interested in is the so-called green lash, and to what extent the vote reflects a sort of popular feeling that they're being just sort of pushed too hard to go to net zero. And we've seen a little flicker of that at times here in Britain, and there's been quite a bit of talk about it. Let's see if this amounts to something.
And also interesting who might be driving that in terms of the demographics of voters, because in the past we always think of people who have been more inclined to sort of Green Party, the rest have been quite young. My colleague Kasia Attler has a piece on bbcnews.com in which she points out how it's millennials and Gen Z who actually are part of the vote going to the far right.
That is even more intriguing. Is a global phenomenon as well. You see the same generational split in, you saw it in Argentina with its election last year. You've seen it in South Africa with its elections recently. There is something happening whereby there is a disillusionment among a swathe of 20-somethings around the world with democracy, a sort of frustration with the centre not really getting things done.
Mm. We mentioned the violence that this EU parliamentary election campaign has seen, the attack on the Danish Prime Minister yesterday, the Slovak Prime Minister last month, of course. Germany has seen a run of incidents, some seriously injured, candidates from Chancellor Scholz's party, the SPD, and also from the Greens as well. Many politicians there blame the Alternative for Germany party, the AfD, and their inflammatory discourse. But AfD politicians have also been the victims of political violence themselves. I've been speaking to someone who knows a lot about this from first-hand experience. Marie Collenrott is a Green Member of Parliament for the university city of Göttingen. She was assaulted 2 weeks ago. A 66-year-old man is being prosecuted for insult and two counts of intentional bodily harm.
I was there in the middle of the streets talking to people about the European elections, and then this man approached me, complained about the Greens aggressively, and then basically hit me. He just came towards me, and he was quite angry, and he just started hitting me. And there had not been any political content debate before that assault. So it was just, surprisingly cruel, actually.
And painful.
And painful. After I told him that I would not tolerate this, he hit me the second time. So he was quite aggressive.
Were you worried about what might have happened next? I mean, what was going through your head?
I tried to protect myself, and then afterwards I got help from some very nice colleagues, actually. I'm very grateful for those who bravely intervened during the second attack. And after the attacks, I actually followed him. So I called the police, and then I followed him to wait until the police would arrive to get him.
And what happened?
It took them some time to get there, and I had the police officer on the telephone the whole time and talked to him and described what we are doing and where we are walking through the streets and following this person.
Mm. Before this, had you been worried about your safety as you went about campaigning and doing your job? Because we have seen politicians in Germany attacked, especially in the run-up to these elections this weekend.
Not really. So I'm in Göttingen. Göttingen is a quite nice little city, very friendly people. And I got 35% votes the last time for the regional parliament. So it's quite green also. So I had no worries before that. So there are sometimes some people upset talking to me, of course, as they worry about something, but not in this aggressive way. And they're not attacking, basically. So yeah, that was the first time, and it shocked me.
And yet we have seen, the incident that you've described, there's a colleague of yours who ended up in hospital recently-ish because of an attack. Why do you think this is happening? Why has this become a feature of politics in Germany?
Well, the societal atmosphere is becoming increasingly rough. Cursed language on the streets and social networks, but also in the parliament, legitimizes more and more violence. And I think we must make clear that we do not tolerate violence against members of parliaments and no other people, of course. At the same time, we must take people's serious concerns, fears and anger and talk to them, being available, being on the streets, getting in contact.
You said there that there are some language used by people which legitimized violence, even in the parliament itself. What do you mean by that?
We have the AfD in the regional parliament, far right-wing party. Yeah, they are lying in parliament. They're also cursing in parliament. They're attacking Greens in political debates. They become increasingly personal on individuals.
But AfD party politicians have been attacked as well, haven't they? So they are also the victims of this culture to some extent.
Yeah, that's true, and should not happen to anyone, no matter what party people are in.
That is the Green Party MP in Germany, Marie Collenrott, speaking to me earlier. You're listening to Weekend on the BBC.
The
The Taylor Swift circus has landed in the UK with a bang. Countries around the world have been feeling the Taylor effect as her enormous arena concert troops around 152 dates. In the UK, the economic benefit of her 15 shows here is estimated to be £1 billion. Travel, spending, food, drink, the average ticket is £206, so that'll help. She began in Murrayfield in Edinburgh last night with 73,000 fans watching. The final nights will be in Wembley Stadium, London. Oddly, there's a particular pub in London near there that has become an essential stop for top-tier Taylor fans visiting London. It's name-checked in her latest album, The Tortured Poets Department. My colleague Sean Lay went along.
My name's Jamie. I'm from Philadelphia.
So are you a Swiftie?
I am.
What does it mean? Explain it to somebody ignorant like me.
Having a woman who is comfortable with being herself and having the opportunity to speak up for what it is to represent women, I think it's nice to see someone empowered to acknowledge that we all are human, we make mistakes, and it's okay to be confident in your ability and who you are to continue being authentic.
My name is Caitlin, and I am from Philadelphia, PA in the US.
So tell me, what makes a Swiftie?
I think there's a negative connotation around it too. Someone who's a Swiftie is dedicates their life to Taylor and follows her around, and there is, I think, a subset of that. I just think it's someone who enjoys the music and the lore and the funny. I don't take any of it seriously.
Because you women are a bit older than the image of the Swiftie. You're not 13. Well, no, yeah. Are you 13?
I'm not. So here's the thing. I'm the same age as Taylor. But yeah, she does have a really young following. But I think that's also generational. So I'm now a full adult. I could have children who could be consuming this music at this age. I don't. But you see a lot of generational pass down for it.
What about the parents who worry about the obsession?
I think they should. I don't think kids should be obsessed with anything in that level, whether it's sports, music, anything. I don't think you should be so siloed or tunnel visioned on anything.
Now, I have to ask the question, why did you come to this pub of all the pubs in London? You could have had lunch at.
Yeah, because Taylor Swift wrote a song about it.
And so I watched as you walk into some bar called the Black Dog and pierce new holes in my heart. You forgot to turn it off.
So I've got looks like a family of six here.
Visiting London.
From where?
Idaho.
You had to come here?
Yes, absolutely. I just thought it was cool to be able to come here and say, oh my gosh, I went to the place that Taylor Swift wrote a song about.
Have you been or are you going to one of the Eras concerts?
I went last year in Santa Clara. It was awesome. It was 3 hours long and the production was amazing. It's very easy for younger generations to, I guess, relate to her lyrics and feel that connection to her songs. And it's a fun community to be a part of.
Have you converted any of your family?
No, I've tried, but no, I have not.
Is this your brother?
Yes, it is.
Why hasn't your sister been able to persuade you to fall in love with Taylor Swift's music?
Because Kanye West is better.
Mom's a bit worried there could be a fight breaking out here. And these are your lovely children.
Yes.
And what do you think as a mum of all this excitement and some would say obsession with Taylor Swift?
You know, she's I hate to put role model on her just because it's a lot of pressure. But she's someone to look up for these young girls. She's classy, she's smart, she's a great businesswoman.
So that's a snapshot of views from our American visitors. What about the locals? How do they feel about their regular becoming a phenomenon?
We come here every day and suddenly you can't get a seat because it's full of Taylor Swift people.
Well, it gets that packed.
Yeah, yeah. Queued up to get in.
And this is your local, is it?
Yeah.
So it's a bit annoying.
Yeah.
You haven't got any daughters?
No.
Otherwise, you could bring them here.
Very interesting.
Sean Lay with the plum assignment of being sent to the pub. We're always trying to find ways to categorise musical greatness and success, you know, platinum discs, numbers of streams and everything. Alec, here we have an artist who is shifting GDP with where they go.
Well, it is an extraordinary phenomenon, this. I mean, there were considerable numbers of serious reports done last year in the US economy about the Taylor Swift economy and the impact it had had on American GDP. Now, of course, you're quite right. People are going to be questioning whether her tour here can have the same effect on Britain's economy and may even give a boost to the flagging government, I guess. It is remarkable. What's been more on my mind is that this time I've been ready for you, but in the past I've been ambushed on popular music. Last time,
you're going to start quoting lyrics at us, is that
not quite? But I was asked about heavy metal, and I ended up going to the Indonesian Prime Minister, and who's a big heavy metal fan, as a result of our conversation. Oh, so there you go.
Gosh, Suzanne, what do you make of this? Would you be tempted to go? I mean, it's £200 a pop.
I think I probably would. What I find fascinating about Taylor Swift is the politics of Taylor Swift, particularly in the United States. When I was there as a correspondent during the 2020 election, she famously, after issuing all kinds of political statements, she decided to back Biden. Mm. And this was seen as a huge moment. But more recently, she's become the subject of extraordinary conspiracy theories on the right. She's been dating that star player from the Kansas City Chiefs. It was all American couple, yes. This kind of wholesome American couple, and she attended the Super Bowl. And then there were lots of conspiracies about maybe